蝶，蝴蝶真美丽，飞到东，飞到西，快快飞到我这里，快快飞到我这里。
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. Our opening theme was Butterflies and Flowers, performed by the Jingling Children's Choir.
Ecotopia is made possible by
the generous contributions of the COVID Conscious Chico Certified Farmers Markets, with year-round markets Wednesdays and the North Valley Plaza, Saturdays in Chico at 4th and Wall. Chico Certified Farmers Markets, bringing food lovers and farmers together since 1980.
The opinions expressed on Ecotopia do not necessarily express the views of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
Tonight we'll have two interviews discussing the drastic reduction of monarch butterfly populations in California and around the world. Before we play those interviews, we want to talk about the butterfly effect, which actually has nothing to do with the monarchs, but it's an important reminder of what the demise of a single species can mean.
The term is closely associated with the work of mathematician and meteorologist Edward Lorenz. He noted, metaphorically, that the details of a tornado, the exact time of formation, the exact path taken, can be influenced by minor perturbations.
You know, a butterfly flapped, and that's why you are mispronouncing that word.
It's a perturbation. Yeah. Such as a distant butterfly flapping its wings several weeks earlier. We do live in a cause and effect world, though linking causes with distant effects is so complex as to be, in many cases, impossible to track down.
But we can ask about some pretty clear causal effects when it comes to the monarchs. What is causing their decline and possible extinction? And equally important, what may be the effects on our world if a lovely butterfly disappears? Does it matter?
In our first interview tonight, we'll talk with two students and two community members from Wildflower Open Classroom Charter School who decided that helping the monarchs is worth planting a butterfly garden.
And then we'll talk with Clara Pavelka, an activist from the River Trust, which is planting 600 acres of milkweed all over the state in an effort to restore monarch populations.
We'll take a short break and be back to talk with the folks from Wildflower Charter, where, for full disclosure, Steve is a member of the board of directors.
Here's Flitter Flutter. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and today we're going to be talking about monarch butterflies. With me via Zoom are two students from Wildflower Charter School, Avery Burdett and Sam Sims, and two community volunteers, Heather McCafferty and Chloe Adams. And they've worked on a monarch garden butterfly project over the past couple of years, and we want to talk to them about that, especially since they were able to keep the garden going during the COVID-19 closures. So, kids, Sam and Avery, please say hello so we can hear your voices.
Hi.
Hi. Sam, say hi so we can separate the voice.
Hi.
Hi. And Avery, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Okay. And also Chloe Adams and Heather McCafferty. So let's start. Maybe, Chloe, you could start this one off. Tell us a little bit about the history of the Wildflower Eco Club, which was the source of the Butterfly Garden Project.
The Eco Club was started because the Wildflower School has on the charter, it talks about sustainability. And so there's a position on like the PTA, the WCC. And when I got that position, there was no real guidelines or anything. So I looked on the internet and found the Eco Schools program by the National Wildlife Federation. So to get the award to become an eco school, a eco club has to be started. So that is how it originated.
Okay. And you did get that award like a couple years afterward?
We did. It is a lot of work to get the Green Flag Award, but we made it.
Okay. And then one day I am told a monarch butterfly was seen flying over the playground, and that may have directly or indirectly inspired this project. Sam, do you have something to say about that?
It was actually...
It was not true.
No. It was true. It was it was me and Chloe that saw it. Sam wasn't there.
Okay, the parents.
It wasn't really a monarch.
No, that's a different monarch, honey. A different There was a butterfly that got some attention at school the other day. And they sent me a picture. Kim took a picture of it, and it turned out that it was a different kind of butterfly. It looked like, I can't remember the name of it, but they live and are attracted to passion flowers, but they look a lot like monarch butterflies.
Okay.
And so it was a false alarm. It was a false alarm, but the real story really is that Chloe and I were meeting on campus Sunday talking about the Eco Club and just, you know, throwing ideas around. And, I believe we were talking about this monarch recovery garden concept, and that is part of the National Wildlife Federation Eco Schools. They have a whole guidebook and everything. And as we were talking, we saw a butterfly that we really do believe was a monarch, right, Chloe?
Yes.
Really
okay. But this one for real.
Right. It was for real. And we got so excited. We felt like, okay, that's confirmation, you know, that this needs to be something we do.
It's a sign for sure.
Yeah, we got chills and everything.
Avery or Sam, tell me, why is it important to have a monarch butterfly garden? What's the problem here?
It helps them recover from being extincted. Going extinct.
What do you mean extinct? I mean, you see movies around with millions of monarch butterflies. I don't understand quite what the problem is.
In the last couple of years, they've just been reducing rapidly, down to only 2,000 count this year.
Wow. Okay. And why is that? What's the cause of their decline?
Habitat loss.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you decided to start the garden. Tell us a little bit about what the garden looks like, how you got it started. If both of you could get a little closer to the computer, I think we'll get better sound from the two students. Great, thank you. And just use your, as we say, your outdoor voices if you want to. We're not going to mute you down. So how did you build the garden?
We put wood together.
Chloe, do you want to talk a little about
The planter boxes were already at the school and not being used. Mm-hmm. But they were filled with weeds, and I believe they had been sprayed a bunch with pesticides and herbicides. But I went to a lawn replacement workshop at the Butte Environmental Council,
mm-hmm.
Where I think I maybe met Heather there. Uh-huh. And they did this whole lawn replacement by putting cardboard down and then putting 4-6 inches of mulch on top. So we thought that was going to be the best way to do it without pulling weeds and disturbing whatever soil they had going on there. So we got a bunch of cardboard and a truckload of mulch and just threw it on.
Mm-hmm. And then where did the milkweed plants come from? Did you plant them by seed or starts? I think maybe a little bit of both.
Both. So we got a bunch of seeds and we sprouted them. They're very difficult to sprout. I kept them in the back of my refrigerator for a season, and then we planted them. And we've got probably maybe 30% of the seeds to sprout. And we got those planted. The kids planted them.
Mm-hmm.
And then through some miscommunication or accidents, they got sprayed with herbicides. So those were dead.
We already put up signs.
Yeah, we did.
Yes, we did.
Okay.
We need so many specific signs. It is amazing.
We're very bad at listening to them.
Yeah, they are.
But you've got signs.
It's
now,
been a challenge.
So we're not
just
holding
not
grudges, all right? Okay.
No, okay. For sure, no.
So the second time through, then, how did the planting go? What's come up? Avery, it looks like you're about ready to tell us about that.
Well... The second time we planted them, they worked a little bit, and then they and then we kept checking on them, and then we thought they were gonna die, but then they bloomed.
So. Okay, good. And what has happened since then? I know you were out there during the summer. You've also made a video. And so tell me about how you have maintained it, especially the kid involvement in this project. Sam, looks like you're ready to say something. Sam is making faces at the Zoom camera.
We checked them over the summer, and we made a lot of video thing about them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mix of about the monarchs and about toads.
Right. Yeah, I've seen your video, and I will put the link up on our website so people, it's about a 6-minute video, and it's really well done. So what did you see during the summer? Did you actually see monarchs that summer, or did what evidence?
No, but we did see what we thought was eggs.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't really know for sure because nothing ever came of it.
Okay.
But yeah.
Tell us about the eggs, and how would you know whether it's a real monarch butterfly egg or not?
They're white and very, very small.
Mm-hmm. And where do you find them?
On the underside?
Mm-hmm.
Underside of the monarch leaves.
Okay, right. So if those eggs hatch, and we're hoping you'll see some, what comes out and what's the kind of the life cycle then from monarch?
The caterpillars and then okay. The chrysalis, and then the butterfly.
Okay. I heard somewhere that the caterpillars do not taste good to other species. Is that true?
They probably don't. They do. Yeah.
So what's next for the project? I did hear that the wheat is growing so well that it has overflowed the boxes and is kind of growing out there near the playground.
We've had a really good year. You know, we've had a good bumper crop. You know, last year during 2020, you know, it was we had just kind of started to see the gardens grow, and then everybody got sent home with COVID. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but we had just an amazing, wonderful garden box full of milkweed last year. And so we were kind of waiting, you know, hoping that we'd have another good year of milkweed. And we really have. We've had, you know, most of it has come back. Mm-hmm. And we do have some aphids on our milkweed, which really has been interesting. You know, Sam and I were looking them up and learning about them and what they do to the plants. And, you know.
Is that good news or bad news that you've got the aphids?
Bad. Definitely bad.
Yeah, they're, I guess they're called oleander aphids or little yellow bugs that kind of suck the juices out of the milkweed. And I mean, they can kind of hang out on the milkweed and not bother them too much. But after a while, if there enough of them get on there, they do hurt the milkweed and
can even kill it.
Yeah, we looked up, you know, we thought, oh, well, let's get some ladybugs. You know, that'd be a great way to handle mm-hmm. this. But then we did some more reading and found out that the ladybugs would eat monarch eggs too, so we just kind of held off.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We see that a lot, don't we, in sustainability efforts. You bring in one species to control another, and pretty soon that one gets out of control. There are many examples of that around the world today.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Sam and Avery again, tell me, what do you hope, not only from your efforts with the monarch garden, but what do you hope for the future of the monarchs? Are you optimistic that you think we can bring them back? Maybe not to the levels that they were before, but that we can certainly save them from extinction. Tell us what you think about that.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't think our garden will save them, but I think it might do something.
Yeah.
Great. Anything else you want to tell me about either the Eco Club and your next plans or your additional thoughts you might have about monarch butterflies or ways of preserving them?
No. Because I don't have any.
I think, I mean, one idea we have, but, you know, Chloe and I are excited to meet with the kids again and see what ideas they have. But we do want to plant some more nectar plants, some flowers uh-huh. that would right. really sustain the butterflies mm-hmm. because they really are, they need more than the milkweed. You know, we're also on a learning journey with all of this. There's so much to learn about monarchs and mm-hmm. realize that.
And you said, I think that you hope to have this as part of the wildflower curriculum in the fall. And also you've used the video at the Valene Smith Museum, Heather, where you work. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, the video was for, I work at the museum and we turned our museum summer camp to virtual last summer. Mm-hmm. And so we were all kind of tasked with trying to create some kind of virtual content. So Sam and I and Avery, we all just, when we went to the school to go check on the milkweed, we decided to start taking some video and ended up turning it into, you know, something to share with the campers so they could learn about the monarchs.
Great. Okay. Well, I want to thank you four for being with me on Ecotopia tonight. My guests have been Sam Sims, Avery Burdett, Heather McCafferty, Chloe Adams. They're part of the Eco Club at Wildflower School and doing great work endeavoring to create a viable place for the monarchs to roost and to be healthy. Thank you all for being with me tonight.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break and be back to talk with Claire Pavelka of River Partners. Meanwhile, as an interlude, here's an aria from Madam Butterfly, Un Bel Dì, One Beautiful Day. This is Eco.
Zikatopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and tonight we're talking about the decline in monarch butterfly populations and what can be done about it. One organization taking major action is River Partners. It's a statewide organization. It does have offices here in Chico, and it engages in a wide range of restoration projects, including, but by no means limited to, rivers. One of their big projects at the moment is the monarch recovery.
Claire Pavelka is on the phone with us now. She grew up in Sonoma County, spent a lot of time in the oak woodlands. She caught butterflies and blue-belly lizards. She's a recent graduate from Santa Clara University. She got a degree in biology and environmental sciences, and now she's working with the River Project Partners as a restoration biologist. She works out of the San Joaquin Valley region, but we want to emphasize there is a Chico office of River Partners as well. Welcome, Claire Pavelka.
Hi, thank you for having me on today.
So our first question, I was a butterfly catcher as a kid, and I want to know if you engaged in catch and release or whether, as I did, yeah, I killed them.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I was rarely fast enough to catch any of the butterflies that I was hunting, but I would usually catch and release. But my dad grew up in Southern California and had a pretty extensive collection, so it was always cool to see the butterflies that he had growing up.
Mm-hmm. Right. Let's talk now about what's your work as a restorationist for River Partners? Are you exclusively the Butterfly Project? You work on rivers? Tell us a little more about what you do for them.
Yeah, so I'm pretty new to the organization. I just started last October. We're mainly working on restoring river habitat along different rivers in the San Joaquin Valley. The Monarch Project that we'll be talking about today just happens to be one of the newer projects that we've been working on to implement. But we work to do everything from collecting native seeds to helping to plan restorations, helping to implement all those restorations, monitoring to see how well the plantings are doing, writing reports, and that pretty much covers it.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in a nutshell,
okay.
But also I guess speaking on pretty cool radio talk shows.
That's fun.
Yeah, great.
So why does River Partners, and presumably you, why do you think preservation of the monarchs is so important?
Yeah, so monarchs are an important part of the ecosystem that we have here in California. They're pollinators for a lot of the native milkweeds that we have and other plants, and they're also food sources for predator species. But more importantly, they're kind of the flagship species for other pollinators and insects. A lot of people obviously know about monarchs, and they're really charismatic and really well studied. So their really rapid decline kind of is a big representation for a decline in other pollinator species that are less well studied. So they're this really cool symbol of kind of conservation for pollinator and insect species. So that's kind of, I think, not only are they important in their own right, but they represent so much more.
What are the declining numbers like? Is it precipitous?
Yeah, it's pretty rapid. So in the 1980s, there was an estimated 4.5 million Western monarch butterflies. A lot of people can remember going out to places like Pacific Grove, which is kind of nicknamed Butterfly Town USA, and seeing like huge numbers of butterflies at the overwintering sites. So the most current count has that Western monarch population at less than 2,000 as of last year. So from the 1980s, that's about a 99.9% decline in the population. Yeah. So it's been pretty rapid.
Wow, that's huge.
And
they migrate. They have a long migration, right? They go from Mexico to and southern Mexico, like Oaxaca or someplace. And then how far north do they go?
Yeah, so there are two different populations of monarchs in the U.S. So the eastern population is the one that migrates down to Mexico and back up north to places like Michigan. The population that we have here, the western population, is more centrally located around California. So they'll migrate, you know, the coastal sites in California like Monterey and Santa Barbara, places along the coast. And then they will migrate up to places as far as Idaho, up in Nevada, even down to Arizona when they're on that migration. So it's pretty extensive migration that can really span a couple states. It's really impressive for an insect to be able to do that.
And what is the reason for their migration? Is it related to reproductive patterns or food sources or what?
Yeah, so monarchs have been termed as a species that's really wedded to water ways. So they kind of follow plants as they bloom and go throughout California in the, you know, March and April time, and then as it becomes later in the summer, they'll head up into those southern states, and then when it gets to winter time, it gets really cold in some of the states that are more north and east and kind of more in the middle of the U.S. So they'll come back to California because it's more temperate and they're able to overwinter there. So it's a kind of a combination of factors, but that's also just how they evolved to be. So it's a pretty impressive that an insect is able to migrate thousands, hundreds of thousands of miles in some cases, and they touch so many different people in those different states as well.
So amazing. I use that word too much, but it is amazing. And so what do we know about the cause of their decline? Is it climate change? Did we do it, we human beings, by changing, you know, what's available to them? Why are they in decline?
Yeah, so it's really a combination of factors. And although, you know, normal populations of different animals will fluctuate, you know, every year due to natural threats like predators or disease, natural threats in this case are likely not the cause of the rapid decline that we've been seeing. So that combination of human caused factors, it has to do with habitat loss, decline in milkweed availability for monarchs, climate change, but I think the two most important ones are really the decline in habitat that they have available and the decline in milkweed. So for listeners that don't know, monarchs, they can drink nectar from any flowers, the adults, but the caterpillars have to be laid on milkweed plants to be able to grow. So they're really tied to that milkweed for reproduction, which sometimes I think gets a little lost in translation. But if adult monarchs will lay eggs on a different plant, the caterpillars just won't eat unless it's milkweed. So that's a really essential piece to them being able to continue surviving in the West Coast. And climate change too is part of it, mostly because there's an increase in extreme weather events that can really throw off their migration or kill a lot of monarchs at the same time. Especially things like wildfires in California, that's really difficult for the butterflies to manage. And there's a lot of shifting habitat availability as well that's coming with climate change.
I've been noticing that there's a lot more wind than there used to be. And I think that's a part of climate change as I understand it. And that must have some effect on butterflies and their ability to function.
Yeah, I think, you know, as those more extreme weather events start occurring more, unlike things like maybe birds that are migrating, you know, monarch butterflies aren't strong enough to kind of pull themselves out of those extreme weather events. So it's really difficult for them sometimes to get out of the way of things, and a lot of times they don't. So that can be one thing that really critically hampers them as they're migrating or moving throughout the state of California and beyond. But yeah, it's really a combination of factors for their decline. It's hard when you get down to population sizes that are, you know, really small, like the ones we have for the monarchs currently. A lot of things can start to affect it.
Could you tell us a little bit about the life cycle of the monarch from egg laying to adulthood? We'd mentioned overwintering. Do they need the whole winter to reproduce, or is it, as I suspect, a little more rapid than that?
Yeah, so their life cycle is a little complicated, mostly because it's tied to the different seasons when they migrate. I would encourage listeners for some more extensive information on that after I explain a little bit to visit Xerces Society. They're a great resource for monarch conservation, have a lot of good images to go along with it. But there's usually a sequence of four to five generations that the monarchs will accomplish. So each generation is usually located with a different area. So monarchs will start out breeding, and that's mostly along the Central Valley, Sacramento Valley of California. So that happens during March to April. Around April, March, after they have bred, that next generation that's born will kind of migrate, start migrating kind of east and north, depending on where the milkweed is available, where pollinator plants are available as they migrate. And then that kind of happens from March to August, so over the summer. From August to November, they're still kind of starting to migrate back to the coast because it's starting to get cold again in those more northern and eastern areas. And then in November to March, they're overwintering those coastal sites. So it's kind of complicated because it's multiple generations. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like you're handing off a relay stick to the next butterfly. That butterfly is taking you farther across the migration pattern. But a lot of times in the places where they're just migrating, they only live, you know, maybe a month, a couple weeks. But when mm-hmm. they do that big overwintering journey, that they can live up to 9 months. So it's very interesting to see how the different generation times and how the areas where they are really affects their life cycle.
So do you see them a lot where you are? You're in San Joaquin?
So I'm in the San Joaquin region around the Modesto area.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a lot of them in Chico, but I might not be in the right places to be seeing them. But are there a lot in that kind of Central Valley area? Have we typically in the past had a lot of monarchs in this area?
So I think in the past, when they've been on their migration, their breeding habitat is really important in the Central Valley. So that's when the monarchs are starting to make their journey inland, and they really need those milkweed plants and pollinator plants to be able to breed and refuel. So around March to April, maybe a little bit later, is usually when we see some of those butterflies in the Central Valley. I personally haven't seen a lot, but we also just started planting these awesome monarch projects through River Partners, so we're hoping that that'll help out with that migration and hopefully let us see some more monarchs as in our Modesto area out here.
Tell us now about the milkweed planting project, and then we'll ask you the big question about whether or not it can be effective. So you have, I think, 600 acres under cultivation at this point?
Yeah, so River Partners is working throughout the state to plant milkweed across 8 different sites, ranging up where y'all are in Chico, all the way down to the Imperial Valley near San Diego. So like you mentioned, we're enhancing over 600 acres with that native milkweed and pollinator plants. So I know some local areas for you guys are the Oroville Wildlife Area and Upper Butte Basin Wildlife Area. So plantings are completed at Oroville, and then Upper Butte Basin is scheduled to be planted this fall, which is really exciting. And I know that both of these wildlife areas are open to the public, so that's really exciting as well.
So who's doing all this planting?
Yeah, so it's a really big partnership at River Partners. Partners, obviously, is in our name, and that's really important to the work we do. So we've worked with Cheryl Schultz, who is a researcher at Washington State University, and Xerces Society to kind of come up with good plans and how to kind of design milkweed plantings that will be beneficial to the monarch. So not only are we planting, milkweed for the monarchs now, but the way that we're planting them, we're trying to figure out what's the best way. So closer to the river, bigger plots and things like that. So it's kind of all part of a big experiment as well. So we work in coordination with them. And then we have the science team that I'm on as a biologist works really closely with our operations staff to actually plant the milkweed. And we have to shout out also all the native plant nurseries that have been really integral in helping us get even just the seed for the milkweed as well.
So do you have like local volunteers? I know there are some, the Upper Butte Basin Wildlife Area is on your map as a place that has plantings. Are there local volunteers in that area, or do you send out people from kind of your central location?
Yeah, so it's all our operation staff is mainly all people who work for River Partners.
Okay.
Currently, we're not able to have a lot of people join in on the planting effort, and that's mostly been due to COVID. I know in the past we've had volunteers come out for different things and plant parts of our restoration to learn more about what we do. But yeah, it's mostly just River Partners staff.
And can people see that? Are there ways that they can look at the places where it's been planted? We don't want anybody tromping on anything, but can we visit the areas where there are milkweed installations, for want of a better word?
Yeah, I know that both the wildlife areas are open to the public.
Okay.
Just because I don't work as closely in that area, I'm not sure how close the milkweed plantings are to places where, you know, they're usually not a lot of times super easily accessible, just because of where we're having to plant them. But that's something I can definitely get back to you on, so you can let your listeners know.
You talked about having seed available. Maybe individuals could plant seeds. I'm just wondering if we should be planting. We have a 40-acre farm, and I don't know what they need in order to take hold, but
yeah.
Can individuals or should individuals get seeds and plant milkweed in their gardens?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the biggest challenges for our organization, even implementing this project, was just finding and being able to grow enough seed for all the projects, just because native milkweed is sometimes not readily available. So River Partners itself does not supply seed to the public, just because all the seed that we're, you know, growing and then collecting from, we really need in our restoration projects. But I really would encourage listeners to be planting, you know, native pollinator gardens, and your local native plant nurseries should be really helpful for that. You just want to make sure that you're planting the native milkweed that's supposed to be in your area, because otherwise planting non-native milkweed can kind of throw off the migration pattern of the monarch. So the Xerces Society, I'll plug them again, but they have some great information about what kind of milkweed you should be planting in the area and what other pollinator plants are good plants to plant in a pollinator garden. But yeah, I would definitely encourage listeners to plant things that could help out the monarchs if they want to be involved in that.
Can the monarchs be saved?
Yeah, it's kind of the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think, yeah, obviously, I know I mentioned some stats before, and I know it's been pretty rapid, and a lot of people are kind of shocked by this decline, because I think monarchs are something, you know, my dad talked about being around everywhere and seeing all the time, and I remember personally going to, you know, Pacific Grove as a kid and just seeing thousands of butterflies overwintering. And then, you know, this year, only a decade later, there's no butterflies that we're seeing at Pacific Grove. So it's really shocking. I think something that's really important for everyone to remember is that nature is really resilient. It's kind of incredible what nature can do when it's given the support and given some help. And sometimes it can bounce back. Where I work in the San Joaquin Valley, we've seen some endangered species such as the riparian brush rabbit and the Aleutian cackling geese increase really rapidly, come back in population and almost come back from the brink of extinction in some cases as we're restoring that natural habitat. So I think with Western monarchs, you know, there's a lot of action that's happening. There's a lot of awareness and a lot of people are talking about it. And I think all that action at, you know, the local level and the regional level and the state level is something that's really needed and good and possibly can help save these butterflies. And I think, you know, the more listeners are educated about programs like this and, you know, come together and start planting, you know, native gardens and things like that, the greater chance we all have at preserving this really iconic butterfly so that future generations can enjoy it as well.
Are the monarchs like a canary in the coal mine? We were talking earlier, if the monarchs go extinct, does that imply other insects or animals may go extinct? Is there a chain?
Yeah, I think, like I mentioned before, they're kind of this, because they're so iconic and well-studied, they really are like this flagship species, like this canary in a coal mine that you mentioned. I think there's probably a lot of other pollinator species, a lot of other butterflies and bee species that also might be facing really declining numbers, but just because we don't study them as much as we study monarchs, we might not know the full extent. But by doing things like planting, you know, milkweed and planting pollinator plants that are native to the area, you know, that's really helping out monarchs, obviously, but that's also very beneficial for a lot of other insects that are really essential to our ecosystems. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have also heard about how important bees and different things are to right. all the food that we eat and to our local economies. So it's really interesting how close related, you know, success of the monarchs might be to a lot of other species. So hopefully by taking some action that can kind of help all the pollinator species out there and not just the monarchs.
Right, yeah.
We did read an encouraging article that said the Oregon blue butterfly, which has been the beneficiary of some recovery efforts, is in fact coming back, which is very encouraging. I don't know
That's
the numbers
awesome.
There, but they're better off than they were before. We've yeah. noticed as well, I just want to continue the
okay.
canary. We've discovered yeah. on our farm, which is about 1,288 feet, we had a beekeeper on the farm, but he is not bringing as many hives to our area because buckwheat, which is poison to the bees, you know more about this than I do, Susan, yeah. it has moved up the ridge.
He now comes after they bloomed. When it's not buckwheat, it's I can't say what it is. It's a beautiful white flower, sort of looks like wisteria, but it's poisonous to them. So he's not bringing his bees until after the buckwheat has bloomed and died, or the flowers have died.
And it's coming earlier than it used to due to climate change.
So, right. So, I mean, the relationships, everything is interconnected, and the relationships are so complex and so tight that it's hard to sometimes know what causes some of the problems that they're having and what the impact of particular changes in plant species has on insects. And it's just, we mucked around with nature so much that we've thrown her off quite a bit.
Yeah. I think it's kind of crazy to see what impacts we've had that might be negative. But I think, you know, on the flip side, there's a lot that we can do to also kind of remedy the things that we've done. And I think now more than ever, there's a lot of efforts to be doing that, not only at River Partners, which obviously is very focused on that with restoring different, you know, repairing habitats across the state, but a lot of other organizations and people as well.
Can you talk a little bit more about in a little bit more detail? You mentioned at the start of this kind of all the things that you're engaged in, but are there some other particularly interesting campaigns that River Partners is engaged in that you could tell us about?
Yeah, so one of our big projects in the San Joaquin Valley is located at a place called Dos Rios Ranch Reserve. It's adjacent to the San Joaquin River National Wildlife Refuge, and it's upon completion will be about 2,000 acres of restored habitat that will, you know, add on to that refuge. But that's been a really big place, not only for, you know, restoring, you know, native ecosystems and seeing a lot of the species come back, especially a lot of bird species and things like that, but also a really important place for flood, you know, safety measures and restoring groundwater and, you know, seeing especially as we're in this drought that's already kind of started in California, places like Dos Rios, all the action that we've taken there can actually, you know, help relieve some of that pressure and help maybe potentially mitigate some of those effects of drought. So that's one of our really big projects in the San Joaquin region that we're all really excited about. And phase one of it, the biggest part of it, will be completed in a few years, so that's pretty exciting as well.
So do you have to, when you go into these restoration projects, is part of what you have to do is get rid of invasive species and replace that?
Yeah.
Replace them?
So, yeah, it's a challenge to kind of balance, you know, not using a lot of herbicides and things like that, but also making sure that, you know, our restoration plantings aren't being outcompeted. I think, especially in the first few years of a restoration, because our restorations, they typically only last 3 years. So in the first year, especially as the restoration plantings are just getting established, we really want to give them all the support we can. Our operations team is really dedicated to that, and they're out there every day checking on the field and really aware of what's happening. So they're a really big reason why, you know, the plantings and the restorations do so well. But we do have to spray selective herbicides on some of the more resilient species, but a way that we've kind of gotten around you know, using some things like that, is actually doing competitive planting. So okay. we'll take species like mugwort or creeping wild rye, which
mugwort
is
crazy. Grass.
Yeah. And we'll plant those in kind of the aisles between where we plant the trees and shrubs and things like that. And it does a really good job of kind of outgrowing those invasive species and not giving them enough space to grow. So that's a technique that River Partners uses a lot. And it's interesting because it kind of combines, you really combine a lot of, you know, modern agricultural techniques with the science. So it's really interesting to see how a lot of that agricultural background is so beneficial to the work we do and so important. Yeah.
We have a native plant garden, and the mugwort wants the whole thing.
Yeah.
It just came into really bloom well. This morning. A beautiful yellow, two-tone yellow flower. But yes, it's invasive.
It wants to take over. How do you assess how your restoration is going? You know, what kinds of things do you look at when you're restoring to say, okay, we're making progress here? Are there particular insects or birds or animals, or are there things that you're looking for to saying, okay, this is working?
Yeah, that really varies project to project. It also depends, you know, what the funder of the project wants to see in terms of the data that we collect, but we are really focused on looking at the plants and how well they're doing. So we'll do different things like censusing all the plants that we planted to see the survivorship of different species. That really helps you notice, you know, if one planting is doing well in this area, but maybe not so well in this area. And we do different things like that to make sure that we're planting the restorations right. And it also helps us kind of adapt to what we're doing. So the next time we plant, you know, we can be even more successful. Recently, especially with all the work we've done with monarchs, we've really been able to do some insect monitoring on our plots in partnership with the Xerces Society, which has been really interesting to see. And we also do some bird surveys as well. So, like you mentioned, kind of seeing how the wildlife is using, you know, our different restorations is kind of speaks to how well the restorations are doing. But I know in the Central Valley, where I work, deer are very rare and they're not often seen, which I don't know if that's the same in Chico. I have a feeling it might be a little different. But we saw deer for, I think, the first time in 10 years on our wildlife cameras. So that's been really exciting to see the different wildlife you can also capture on those cameras to see, oh, wow, we haven't, you know, seen that in a really long time. And now we have this beautiful restoration that it can, you know, different species like deer can utilize, and it's doing really well. So
it's really remarkable work. And Claire Pavelka, we want to thank you for being with us. Tell us a little bit more as we close about River Partners, how people can learn more.
How to get in touch.
Or two. Go ahead, Susan.
Or how to get in touch with River Partners.
Yeah. Well, I first off want to say thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of River Partners and get the word out about the Western Monarchs. But for listeners that are interested in our work, we really encourage you to find us at our website and follow us on social media. We also have a blog that you can follow to kind of keep up with the updates that are happening with our restorations and with the Monarch Project. And I also want to take a minute to thank all the partners that work with us on the Monarch Project and work with us on all of our restorations. So.
Great. Yeah, thank you.
Claire Pavelka with River Partners. We really appreciate your articulate answers, not only about the Monarchs, but about other projects that you're engaged in. We appreciate your being on Ecotopia.
Thank you.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Stay tuned for North State Give and Take with Bobby Tryon. She'll be interviewing a bicyclist and activist, Christine Wilhoit. Christine is launching a bicycle ride across the country in support of physical education.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. Exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Be sure to visit our website for notes and recordings of recent programs, plus an ever-growing list of resources provided by our guests. The web address is ecotopiakzfr.com. We also welcome your comments and suggestions. A number of our shows, a lot of our shows, have come from listeners who said, why don't you do a show on this? So send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com and let us know if there's something that you would like to hear about on Ecotopia. Thanks for listening.
You are the new.
I'm from Santa Rosa.
Okay, yeah. Then you came up to Chico State.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And this up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923 and by the printed image.